Welcome to the ARSC Technical Committee session. Glad to see everybody here. The session is on Born Digital. And it strikes me as kind of a, just when you thought it was safe to go back into the water kind of session. At least at our shop, we've been working hard to figure out how to digitize and preserve analog recordings. So, you know, the whole analog to digital conversion thing. Working on it for a long time, feel like we're finally making progress, finally figuring it out. And now collectors are wanting to donate Born Digital material to us. And we need to figure out how to handle that. So I'm very much looking forward to our presenters today in hopes that I can learn something that I can take back to my shop. I think we'll all learn quite a bit. We're going to have three talks and then hopefully some time for questions after that. David Nolan will give us a talk on the basics of Born Digital formats. Chris Lysenik will give us a talk on strategies for managing digital formats, born digital recordings. And then David Julian Gray will give us a case study. So I think it's going to be quite an interesting afternoon. We're going to start with Dave Nolan. Dave is the audio archivist at the 92nd Street Y since 2005, where he manages a collection of almost 20,000 recordings going back to 1949. From 1995 through 2002, he was a reissue producer for Cadman Records label at HarperCollins Publishers, where he produced hundreds of spoken word titles by artists such as Allen Ginsberg, Pablo Neruda, Charles Bukowski, receiving a Grammy nomination for Dylan Thomas. From 1985 through today, he's also been the audio archivist for such New York institutions as the Wetlands Nightclub, the Poetry Project at St. Mark's Church, and Poets House, as well as working with numerous small archives, libraries, and library organizations to set up audio digitization programs and train library staff in audio archiving. Please join me in welcoming David Nolan.
All right, so let's see. There we go. And that's the only flashy animation in the thing here. And the title of the overall afternoon is kind of my fault, my idea, because ARSC tends to concentrate on the archiving of analog material and sticking to the recommended standards of 24-bit 96K broadcast wave files, but the reality is that there is a lot of other material out there, and it's important to know how to deal with it, and we'll see if we can. This is going to be just sort of a very fast, very basic overview. We're going to see if we can get through 60 slides in 30 minutes. So let's plow ahead. So we'll go over a couple of the just the basic things that I'm sure a lot of people in the room already know, but you know, sampling rate. What is sampling rate? It is the number of times the system writes down a number to describe the audio. Typically what you see out there are things like 44.1K. That means it's writing down a number 44,100 times per second. 96K, 96,000 times per second. It's an important thing to know. Basically, doubling the sampling rate will double your need for storage space. Much more important, oh, here we go. See, I don't have my presenter notes here, so it's tough to know what's coming up next here. The sampling rate affects the audible, the ability of the system to reproduce frequencies accurately or perfectly, depending on where you do your research. But essentially, the reason that we started with 44.1 is that it can accurately reproduce signals up to 22,000 plus hertz. Now, there's an awful lot of other sampling rates you come across, especially when prowling audio online. I see a lot of audio out there at 11.025. If you've ever worked in the CD-ROM production field, you may come across 18.9 for the CDIC format. I see a lot of online audio that has been put up at 2205 to save 50% of the space and 50% of the download time. And some pieces of software will play this back normally. Others will play it back at double speed, and you then have to do a sample rate conversion before you can use it. And there's some odd little variations. There's the drop frame formats of 44056 and 479521. So you just have to be aware to, if you are acquiring a piece of audio, a lot of this is oriented towards audio you're likely to get off the internet or trading digital files with people. You have to know your software, know where in your software to check basic things. You may assume that someone sent you a file at a particular bit rate or sample rate or bit depth, but you don't know until you check it, and you may end up wanting to convert things to a more common format for the purposes of your organization. And this is not my favorite graphic representation of bit depth, because really what it should show you is that, I'll give you the example that I usually trot out, which is a 16-bit number is between 1 and 65,000. A 24-bit number is between 1 and 16,777,000. So if you can imagine the 16-bit blue thing in the middle is 1 inch tall, and that the green thing is 256 inches tall and going up three floors, that is the difference in resolution. And that's only eating up 50% more hard drive space. So if you're not aware of that, why people recommend, if you're going to make any improvement to the quality of your audio, 24-bit gets you 256 times the bang for the buck for 50% more hard drive space. Upping the sampling rate, while a good thing, is not going to yield nearly as much benefit there. Now, the other thing that I find a lot of small organizations get very confused with is the concept of bit rate, which is usually expressed in kilobits per second, thousands of bits per second. And I've put up a screenshot. This is one good way to see what your bit rate is. If you control click in the bar along the top of iTunes, you can bring up a column that will show you the bit rate. Let me see if, whoops, can I, oh, I guess I did not bring that. Come on, go back. I4, there we go. Thought I had a second slide where that was blown up a little better. But you can see the top thing there is a sound effect that I downloaded off the internet. My wife and I do some theatrical sound design. 16 kilobits per second, that is just stunningly low, and it sounds it. You'll see below that there's a podcast from Bill Moyers. That's at 48K. That's almost the minimum, although you do see a lot of material out there at 32 kilobits per second. And as you scroll down, there's a couple of things I bought off iTunes for various purposes. Those tend to be all over the map. They can be 128 is about the minimum encoding for MP3 or AAC files, which are data-compressed audio formats that are common for internet delivery. Then you'll see some other numbers in the middle that are 680, 731, blah, blah, blah. Those are things that have been done with Apple lossless compression. And you'll see that the bit rate is all over the map. Apple lossless compression is guessing, or, you know, it has an algorithm that it's dependent upon the material. So you're not going to get a consistent bit rate there, but you're going to save between 50 and 75% of the file size, depending on the complexity of the music. And down there at the bottom, the thing that says 1,411 kilobits per second, that would be a 16-bit 44.1 WAV file. So just to give you an idea, when people are doing data compression for the internet, it's throwing away that much material. I mean, at 128K, which is considered reasonable, it's throwing over 90% of the information away. There are a number of compression schemes that are actually fairly common out there. There are some lossless compression schemes there. I mean, at the top are things that are completely uncompressed, the EBU and the WAV format and AIFF, which is essentially lost the battle with the WAV format to really be significant, but there are a number of pieces of software that default to AIFF. The information contained in the file is essentially the same except for some header information. However, there are a number of lossless compression schemes. FLOC is currently the most popular. It's actually getting a lot of commercial use. So there's a lot of commercial music providers that put their material up in FLOC format, usually accompanied by an MD5 checksum, which is a way to check your data integrity once you have re-expanded the file to its original size. Next to that is an icon from Apple Lossless, which is their proprietary version of compression. Again, you're going to save about 50% of your space. The icon at the bottom left is Shorten, which was a very popular lossless compression for several years with music traders. It has fallen out of favor in favor of FLOC. FLOC is great. You can not just wrap a 16-bit file or a 24-bit file. It supports a system of tags that have some degree of compatibility with the ID3 V2 tags that are common to MP3s. And then that other strange icon of the monkey is Ape, Monkey's Audio, which is another lossless compression scheme that is popular with certain music collecting communities. And this may be a resource. If you're in a library and archive, this is something that I try to bring up a lot. There is a huge amount of material out there for free. And we always talk in terms of digitizing our own collections, and I have very rarely seen libraries and archives, especially with an audio component to them, think in terms of the immense amount of resources that are now being made available via podcast, via websites like archive.org. There's a huge poetry collection at a website called Pensound that has tens of thousands of clips of poetry up there. So there's an awful lot of stuff that libraries and archives could be taking in and adding as a resource. And it's good to know what formats these are out there in. The common compressed, data compressed formats you see out there, obviously MP3 is the biggest one, but you often see a lot of things up there in Windows Media Audio, which is a proprietary format for Windows Media. You can get slightly smaller file sizes for the same level of perceived quality with them. Windows Media is popular with institutions that want to prove they've done their due diligence in preventing people from downloading. Not that you can't find any bright kid to figure out how to siphon the audio off and create a usable file that you can then put on a CD, but where I work, for instance, they're very concerned with copyright issues, and they tend to want to use things that they can at least say that they've made their effort to prevent it from being easily downloaded. Real Audio was sort of the pioneer in this, and I'm not a huge fan of it, but it's still out there a lot. Same reason, a lot of institutions that want to put up something, it's primarily for streaming, although there are ways to download a Real Audio file. And in Windows Media or Real Audio, there are ways to export back to a full WAV file or transcode it to other formats. And at the bottom there, that fish is Ogg Vorbis, again, a data compressed format. Again, popular with certain music collecting communities. If you're a Led Zeppelin collector, you may come across a whole slew of things out there in Ogg Vorbis. And it's also commonly in use on archive.org. When you upload a program to archive.org, you have an option to have them create a variety of derivative formats, and that tends to be a variable bitrate MP3, Ogg Vorbis, and I'm trying to remember what the other derivative format is. So all of those things are what they call lossy audio, and essentially they use something called psychoacoustic modeling. Oh, it's a family presentation, modeling. There we go. And essentially it means some very smart computer programmer has come up with an algorithm to guess which 90% plus of the audio you won't miss. And, you know, the thing is, with the majority of your audience listening on things like iPods and computer speakers, it, to a certain extent, it's less of a consideration for your access copies, your listening copies, things you're delivering. But it is certainly a consideration if you have any interest in archiving the stuff, if it's anything that needs further processing. Losing 90% of your data or, you know, 98% of your data in some cases means that your results will be significantly inferior if you ever have to do noise reduction or raise a level or do some audio compression to get the quiet sounds louder and the loud sounds quieter. So in researching this, I was like, so how many audio formats are there out there? There's a lot of them, like far too many to possibly ever keep track of. That's just page one. Ah, there we go. There's page two. And let's try page three. Now, a lot of these are proprietary audio formats that are indigenous to just one particular piece of software. But again, it's important to know that there are this many bizarre little proprietary formats out there. Usually, I recommend to people to, you know, if they're really trying to get a piece of audio out of one of these programs that has its proprietary thing, you really want to figure out a way to either export it or use a program that is able to siphon that audio off internally in the computer and create a usable WAV file for you to archive or work with. Now, just because something is uncompressed does not necessarily mean that I'm talking about data compressed, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a 16-bit 44.1 audio file. There are an awful lot of things that create files natively in much lower resolutions. I just had to do an archival, a forensic thing that didn't work out for a poor reporter who had used one of these Olympus shirt pocket recorders to interview Sumner Redstone. He had a 2-hour interview. He's never going to get it again. And unfortunately, on the menu, it said, I'm HQ, high quality settings. It turned out he was making a 4-bit recording. It was stunningly unusable, and even after opening it up in peak and bumping it up to a much higher bit depth, there was virtually nothing we could do because there was just so little information out there. And again, you have a wide variety of sampling rates that people may use for different purposes. I see a lot of these lower sampling rates on websites that are trying to save server space or download time, and you just kind of have to be aware that when you're downloading something, even if it says that it's uncompressed, it may have been created natively at a lower level of quality than you were aware. So, and again, back to the bitrate thing. This is just sort of a very brief overview. 800 bits per second is about the minimum necessary for recognizable speech. You don't see that much out there. There are certain telephone speech codecs that are as low as 8 kilobits per second. Typically for audio delivered on the internet, that 16 kilobit per second sound effect notwithstanding, typically you see stuff out there at between 32 and 320. An awful lot of radio station streaming audio is at 32K. And it's listenable on computer speakers. It sounds pretty terrible, worse than AM radio in many cases. When you see people in the industry, in the internet industries, describing these things, you'll very often hear them talking about anything between 96 and 128 being FM quality. And once you get up around 192 to 256 or 320 tends to be the upper limit on most encoders, you see an awful lot of manufacturers describing their product as creating CD quality audio. And this leads to an awful lot of confusion when working with libraries or archives that may not have audio expertise, because someone has just spent a month telling them that an MP3 is CD quality, which people who work in the archiving end of things know is not necessarily true. And you know, a lot of things that you hear on the radio you may not realize have been through one or another forms of these compression. All the great classical music you've been listening to off the NPR satellite has typically been transmitted as a 256 kbps MP2 over the NPR distribution system. So, you know, it's pretty good. You can listen to it on your FM radio and it sounds good, but you've got to realize that it has been through some data compression and lost, you know, 3/4 of the original information. Or if it was a 24-bit recording, it's losing a far greater percentage. Let's see. Oh, there was my blowed-up slide of the bit rates. Let's just move on. So when we're talking about things that are born digital, it can come from any of a variety of sources. You know, a lot of people are out there using various field recorders. These are a couple of hard drive recorders. That one on the right, if anybody knows where I can get a grant to buy the Atten Kantar, it's a lovely machine. The thing on the left is a sound devices recorder. Those are quite popular with people doing high-quality recording. These tend to record to a WAV file on a hard drive. You can hook them up to your computer via FireWire or USB and drag the files off pretty quickly. Then there's obviously a lot of flash recorders out there. I actually own the Tascam HDP2 there on the left. That's a great machine, but it's already a couple of years old, and everybody's coming out with stuff that's 1/4 the size, so I feel like I'm dragging around a dinosaur at this point. Now, one of the caveats is that a lot of organizations will buy this equipment, and these are capable of recording natively as an MP3. You can select any of a variety of formats. So just because something's been recorded on something that's 2496 capable does not mean that they're bringing home something that we would consider an archival file. The example I always trot out is Penn American Center, a very A-plus list literary organization in New York, did a big festival a couple of years ago. They sent out a fleet of interns with the MicroTrack 2496 there on the right and had them record everything as 128 kbps MP3 files because their primary consideration was getting it back to the office and instantly putting it up on their website. And they were not at all thinking in terms of it being an archival file of any kind. And, you know, the thing is, these things do sound pretty listenable. I mean, we listen to cassettes for years. So, you know, I don't object to that as much as many other people in the archival field do. And then you have these lovely, newer, even tinier digital recorders that have come way down in price. Actually, the one on the left here is a more standard Olympus voice recorder. That's what I had to take the 4-bit file off of for this poor reporter. The one on the right is their LS10 that a lot of people are liking very much. Now, it has you know, very minimal inputs, mini plug input, but it will do a 2496 file. So, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that's considered born digital. There's, you know, 15 or 20 years worth of DAT recordings out there. Generally, you know, 16-bit 44.1. You know, it could have been recorded on a workstation. But however files started, whether it was as sound in the airwaves or whether it's an archival transfer through a converter into a WAV file, pretty much everything we're dealing with has a digital birth date. So, you know, and you may be acquiring files from somebody else who digitized an analog thing. So, you know, I think these principles apply to everything. It's not necessarily something that was strictly born digital. I mean, at one point it was sound in the air before it hit a microphone and got turned into digital information. So it's, to me, it's essentially the same as an archival transfer. Now, of course, this ends up as data, and this is something I've actually come across a fair amount, is that a lot of organizations that were doing audio work only 12 or 15 years ago have a lot of their files on what are increasingly hard-to-find data-carrying formats. Up there you see a zip drive on the top left, jazz drives. We archived stuff when I was at HarperCollins on jazz drives for quite some time. and then my favorite difficult-to-deal-with format, the exabyte, which was the choice for Sonic Solutions users for many years. HarperCollins has, you know, several thousand exabyte archives. Who knows if those are ever going to be recoverable because they didn't have a constant data migration program. So, so let's do a very quick history of digital recording. Basically, the first real commercial digital recording started around 1976 with SoundStream. If you're an archivist and you come across SoundStream recordings, I consider you very lucky, okay? But that's something that most of us are commonly not going to come across unless we get a special gig. The first digitally recorded record album was Ry Cooder's Bop Till You Drop. That's 1978, sort of the dawn of studio digital recording. But what I wanted to move into was really talking more about things that we're likely to come across in the library and archive field. This is the first format that I tend to come across. Sony put out in 78 the PCM1. It was marketed as being able to hook up to any VCR. Basically, it was available in 12 or 14-bit versions. The frequency response was about 30 hertz through 15K. Really pretty good for a first prosumer, you know, marketed across a wide range of end users. But I come across a surprising number of tapes like that from the early days. In fact, there we go. Marketed as consumer audio machine. Okay, so next is a more professional format that is still in use in many mastering houses to this day, the Sony PCM1600, 1610, 1630, and that was typically used with U-Matic tapes, and again, that tended to be a 16-bit 44.1 file on there, and I believe, and I do not have complete information on a lot of these, so if anybody wants to chime in and correct me or add to this, I believe that these machines have a digital out, so if you come across a stash of these that need to be archived, they can be loaded digitally into a workstation. So there we go. Now, this is a big one. The PCM-F1 was the first really widespread portable digital field recording rig. Typically sold with the bigger units you see on the sort of the left-hand side are a Betamax VCR that was made specifically to go with the F1 encoders you see towards the right. Radio stations, concert producers, there's tens of thousands of these tapes out there, and not a lot of F1 rigs currently in use. I mean, they pop up on eBay infrequently, and I believe the technical committee is attempting this year to come up with a roster of people who are capable of transferring different formats. This debuted with a 14-bit recording system as opposed to 16-bit, so that's something else you have to be aware of. Now, if I understand correctly, this particular rig does not have a digital output. However, luckily, if you... Let's see, let's move on. Come on, next slide. There we go. Sony put out a number of decoders for this format that do have a SPDIF out on them. This is the one that we have up at the 92nd Street Y, a PCM1701ES. I believe they had a 501, they had a 601. So those are units that you might want to track down if you're trying to take the information. Now, the tapes themselves are turning out to be fairly robust and long-lived, so you know, as digital tapes go, they're not nearly as fragile or in danger of immediate expiration as that, but it's probably a good idea if you come across a large archive of these to get cracking with a migration plan and to try and get one of these units so you can load the material off digitally. Then, unfortunately, I should have asked Bob Heiber for a copy of his DBX 700 picture because I could not find one to save my life. Now, I have a DBX 700 at work as well because for about 2 years the Y was recording in that format. It was sort of a very interesting format. It was a huge sampling rate of 644 kilohertz, greater dynamic range than the PCMF1 and the first 1-bit Delta Sigma audio converter out there. The problem with this is, of course, there's no digital output on a DBX 700. When you're archiving these tapes, the recommendation is to just play it out through the highest quality analog to digital converter you can and re-digitize the material. And, you know, we've done 2 years worth of concerts that sound perfectly fine. No dropouts, no problems whatsoever on these, at least with our collection. And then, of course, here's one that's a huge problem, DATs. And extremely widespread for many, many, many years at this point. And there's just so much stuff out there. Typically 16-bit, although there was briefly a 24-bit DAT recorder that would record an hour's worth of material on a two-hour tape. You may find, and I found this a lot, people trying to record long-form events were recording at 32K, which has a slightly reduced frequency response, but it let them get 4 hours on a two-hour tape. So, again, something you need to be aware of. Most workstations, if you load in digitally, will be capable of clocking to the 32K signal off of the DAT machine if you're trying to load these in and archive them. There's also a way to use a Sony DDS SDT9000 data drive with a program called DAT2Wave that is currently past its end of life, but there's still copies out there floating around. You can archive your DATs at about double speed. And very briefly, I wanted to just hit the two main tape-based digital multi-track formats. This was Tascam DA88. I don't know why I put that one first, because really the first one was the ADAT. We'll get to that. But essentially, eight tracks typically paired up with, you know, 3 to 6 machines to do a multi-track recording. These were great, but again, an obscure format that finding a working machine and to get the digital signal out of them, you have to get a 25-pin D-sub connector on the back to an AES, four AES stereo XLRs out of the back of the thing. And a number of institutions I'm working with are frantically working to offload all their multi-track material. ADAT, much more common, actually. And again, tens of thousands of professional music studios use this format and rely on it. And this is a huge problem. Now, there's more ADAT machines out there, but so here we go. Yes, and the one outgrowth of ADAT is that they came up with the light pipe format, which is sort of an 8-channel fiber optic cable that you see actually to this day on a lot of other digital audio equipment. And there were other manufacturers that put out knockoffs. There's the Fostex RD8, the Panasonic MDA1. So there are other machines floating around out there if you have a huge stash of these. This is another one I see an awful lot with audio archives, oral historians especially, and I know that Andy Lancet at WNYC is dealing with untold thousands of mini discs from the news department that was using these for reporters. And while mini disc machines are still available, they're not as commonly available as they used to be. And I honestly do not have enough experience taking the digital output on the back of a professional mini disc machine and comparing the output of that with the output of the analog jacks and redigitizing it. So I'm not going to speak about that much more. What you should know is that this also used a form of lossy compression called ATRAC, which, to a certain extent, had slightly better perceived audio quality than similar MP3 and Windows Media and Real Audio encoding. Something that actually came out relatively recently, and these are still available, is the High MD. I still see a lot of oral historians using this. This is actually kind of nice because if you come off digitally from this, someone has recorded a full 16-bit 44.1K wave file. You can get this off the media and into your archiving system bit for bit as it was recorded. Then this is my personal favorite. This is my personal favorite because this is a format that the 92nd Street Y bought into. This looked like a great idea for 6 months in the year 2000. It's a very robust format. It is a recordable DVD inside a hard plastic shell, and it was picked up essentially by the film sound industry that still sells certain portable location recorders. It's a great two-track machine. You can select whether it's a 16 or 24-bit, whether it's 48, 44K, 48K. I believe you cannot do 96K on these. However, getting the audio off these without a working DVD RAM machine, 5 minutes? Okay, we'll blaze on through, can prove difficult. We've ended up having to pop the DVDs out of the housing, and about half of them you can drag the file off of, but if the file was pre-allocated by the recording engineer, you have to go through a very kludgy workaround to open the audio in a third program, copy, paste it, export it. It's a big pain in the butt when you try to drag the file off of a pre-formatted DVD RAM. The system just hangs. So there we go. This is actually, you know, when you talk about physical media, the price of these cards has dropped so much that I have actually come across some organizations that are choosing to save and label their CF cards and their SD cards. I think that's a bit dicey, but there are people doing this, and it's something to be aware of. Let's see. What else is out there as media? There we go. This tends to be what we think of as media these days. It's your hard drive, and I actually very much like the Glyph GT keys, not just because they're a robust hard drive, but because they have 100% free data recovery. I get no compensation from Glyph at all. All I know is that 3 times we've had a drive fail, and 3 times they've had it back to us in 48 hours with the data recovered for free. And so when your people in your bean counting department say, why are we spending 30 cents a gigabyte on this professional level drive when I can go to Staples and get a terabyte for $100? It's, well, you know, I've had 2 LaCie terabyte drives die in the past year. No data recovery under $1,500 for either of those. So, you know, so that's something I recommend. And then, of course, LTO tape. John Spencer, you see here? No? Okay. Standard enterprise class data backup solution. I'm going to very quickly go through just a few clues, because if someone has bumped something up to 44.1 from MP3 after taking it, this is a big problem in the music trading community. Something may have gone through a lossless generation that you don't know about, and then they've handed you a CD. Look, I burned you a CD. You don't know where it's been. So I'm just very quickly going to, and I'm going to show you a relatively extreme example, and this is a case of where you're going to have to educate yourself. These are screenshots of WaveLab, which has a very nice FFT analysis in there. This is just an original file of Pink Noise, and if you do the FFT analysis, it's a fairly steady line there. Now, here's one. Let's see. I can't even read my notes here. Basically, I did 3 different versions of 32K MP3s. I picked an extreme example to show you how much you could lose. I believe this one was done in, good Lord, can anybody read that up there? Does it say Peak? Yeah, Peak with the lame encoder. And here we go. There's your FFT for Peak. So you see a fairly severe drop-off up there around 5, 6K or thereabouts. Okay, here's another one. I believe this one, does that say WaveLab or Peak up there? Does it say WaveLab? Ah, there we go, WaveLab. And the FFT drops off severely at actually a slightly higher level. So this is something else to know, is that if you are encoding listening copies, not all MP3 encoders are created equal. And here, I'll just show you the last one. This is an iTunes MP3 at the same rate. And it's kind of tragic, because a lot of people use iTunes to encode their podcasts, their online delivery media, and it is significantly worse than a lot. And this is done with the lame encoder through iTunes, so it's theoretically the same encoder, and yet you still come out with inferior results. So, all right, I'm out of time, so let's see. Very quickly, this is what I said earlier, you know, lossy audio can be a resource in your library or archive. There is just so much great material out there. My iPod is 90% news and poetry and stuff like that, very little music, and I try to archive a lot of stuff because, you know, people put up a weekly podcast, they may take it down after the first week, and that's come and gone, and you've missed a great resource. There's tremendous, tremendous stuff out there, and if the idea is to make content available to your audience, I think there's nothing wrong with archiving these and making them available as a resource in your institution. You know, they may not be archival quality files, but it's no different than subscribing to a newspaper and keeping that kind of thing on hand. Yeah, it's just a close-up of the New Yorker has a great series up there where you can hear great writers reading their own stories. Also, if you want to get audio off the internet that's in streaming format, there are a couple of very inexpensive programs that, like, this is Audio Hijack for the Mac. On the PC side, there's Total Recorder that will let you select the audio that is passing through just about any program that's streaming audio. And this particular one, I believe Total Recorder is the same, will let you pick a number of target formats. This is one of those odd pieces of software that defaults to AIFF. No choice for WAV in there, but it lets you select, you know, any given number of resolutions in there. I use this all the time. This can even automatically record internet radio broadcasts and automatically shove them over to your iTunes. So let's just do really quick. You know, with the new or original audio assets that you're creating in your library archive, you do the best you can. Obviously, if you can shoot for the 2496 files, that's great. Or if you're taking in things at 1644, that's great. If you're encoding things to MP3, try to at least pick a better resolution for your audio. But for acquired audio assets that are coming in from all over, you've just got to accept that there's an awful lot of stuff that's all over the map out there that may be a good resource. And the idea is to educate yourself as to, you know, what is possible, what are the limitations of it, and also to transcode or bump it up to something that's a more standard format for your archiving and delivery and access systems as they may be in your libraries. So that's it for me, and now we'll have some more in-depth information from our other speakers.
Thanks, David. We'll be holding questions until the end.